Well, welcome everybody to a new episode of Adventures in the Creative Industries. Today, my guest is Pablo Fernandez Clark.
Very good.
Yeah, very good. Sure. Got it right. Pablo is an illustrator, comic book artist, storyboard artist.
Yep.
And can we say animator as well now?
Yes. Yeah. You can. You can. Animator. Animator. Sometimes.
Animator. Sometimes.
Came about. Yeah.
Well. Pablo and I met in 2014 when we were together on Pitch Week of Well Park, a cartoon series for tenants, together with the boys at Something Something.
That's right, yeah.
At the time. Should I call them the boys? It's not like...
Yeah, well, the boys, the men.
The men
they've
now?
Grown they've grown into men.
They've grown into men.
Yeah, Studio Something, well, formerly Something Something, now yes. Studio Something.
Shout out to Jordan and Ian. And thank them for putting us in touch.
Yeah.
Pab and I were together on Weld Park for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And it was very good fun.
Yes.
We fell out. We had some drama. We hated each other for a while, but always in good spirit, I would say.
Yeah, well, I think it was in pursuit of trying to do the best thing possible. Right,
yes. Like,
trying to make the best thing possible with, I mean, certainly in my, talking about myself, with a limited knowledge of what I was doing.
Well, like, I think we had different views on certain topics. Although, like, I would also say that we were under pressure a lot.
And yeah.
We were in the office a lot, especially you and I, because we both had very long days because you were drawing non-stop and illustrating every single thing in Weld Park and I was animating it.
Yeah, well, I think that's totally right. I think that's quite an interesting point as well, because although everyone was very busy, I think when being busy is at its hardest is when there's a bottleneck, and you are that bottleneck. So if there's a limit to how much you can produce, You feel the pressure of all other deadlines like pushing right behind you, you know, and
yeah.
So yeah, I think it was very busy, and it felt even busier because everything was done at a gallop, and everything was a series of bottlenecks. So we were running from one bottleneck to another.
It was a lot of problem solving. That's true, and
a lot of problem solving at a run. You know, there was very little time to go. let's think about this for a minute.
Okay, that's for the people that don't know. Weld Park was the two series of Weld Park. The first series were like 35 episodes we made in 4 months.
Yeah.
So you do the math. It's about 16 weeks. So we done about 2 episodes per week. The episodes were like either 30 seconds or 60 seconds or in between.
Yeah.
Pablo drew every single thing on that show. And it was a cartoon, so there was a lot of drawing to do. And we also got it wrong a couple of times, so Pablo had to redraw stuff, which was good fun. And we also, like, we had... Tenants was a great client because they were elastic enough to let us do whatever we could have to make it happen. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's
they were never a problem. They were never a problem. They were always on our side. And I would say the same with the other agencies that collaborated with us. But for us, it was, a challenge to hit the deadline we imposed ourselves, and B, it was fun. Let's face it, because we worked really, really hard, but we also had a cracking good time. I think on second season, we hit these issues with, like, we started arguing a little bit, and like, I want to talk about this in the podcast, because usually you don't talk about this stuff publicly.
Sure.
Like, you always seems like a happy go-getter, it's all good, you're working hard, you're a bit tired or whatever, but like, the second season we really hit it in a way that, like, I think we were coming already wary from season one. We knew how much work was needed to be done, at least I'm talking for myself.
Yeah.
And I think that coming into season two, I wanted to do something better, trying to push the boundaries again and try and see if we can improve the episodes. Which in a way we did, because, like, also you I remember you were of the same sort of mindset, because you remember you wanted to redraw a certain aspect from season one,
yeah.
which we all thought you were absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, I think I was. you know, in hindsight, I think I was. Well, that's an interesting thing, right? Like as an artist or as a creative person, you want the newest thing that you're doing to be better than the previous thing that you're doing, that you've done. And so, yeah, I wanted to feel like there was a sense of progression in the thing that we were working on.
And I agree with that. Like, to me, it was also like, it was what made it interesting. It was that aspect of progression, of getting better, doing, like, challenging ourselves again.
Yeah.
Although, I think that's what backfired in the end. It was like...
Yeah, I don't think I was smart about it at all. I think I was coming at it from a... I almost created a problem that didn't need to be solved, which I would say, there's no prospective clients listening, but I would say that defines a lot of my previous work that I've worked on, is I'm often trying to solve problems that maybe aren't there. And so like redrawing a bunch of these assets was really time consuming. And ultimately, I don't think a lot of the assets that I redrew were better. I think they were just slightly different. They were more detailed, maybe.
A lot more.
Yeah,
detailed.
More a pain in the ass to work with, and that's because I think my personal ambition was getting ahead of what benefited the project ultimately.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I think that's a constant struggle.
Yeah, and I think I was in the same ballpark in a way that, like, I tried to make my life harder to try and do more. And I think I came into the project, and that is probably it's my fault, already tired, because I had already, like, a very busy period. So my mindset, I wasn't fresh,
yeah.
You know. I wasn't
yeah.
coming in saying, I can't wait to get this started. I came in was saying, I can't wait to get this started, but I'm a bit tired.
Yeah,
and that was for me was a big deal that I overlooked that aspect too much.
Burnout is a total killer as well, because
yeah.
burnout there's two it works in two ways. There's the burnout where you ultimately can't do any more. You know, it just stops you stop being able to produce because you're done. But there's another one, which is the slow burn up to that, which
yeah.
is that you've maybe burned through your resources of adrenaline. You know, the first part of Whale Park was done with us working very late at night, with us pushing ourselves to learn new things constantly. You know, that stuff's really tiring, and the mental engagement, as well as kind of the physical thing of just being in this space constantly and working, is really hard. It takes its toll. And when you burn through those supplies, going into a new project means that you don't have them to call on as much. So
I think so. I mean, like, burnout is something I definitely want to touch on. I've asked all my guests so far what were their thoughts on burnout, and, well, almost all my guests. But, like, I think I struggle with the idea of not working.
Yeah, same.
So, like, if I have a project and I know I can deliver it, I want to do that project. But the problem is
yeah.
there is a point in time where you have to stop. And, like, the problem with stopping for me and why I fall into this burnout period is, like, my stopping, it's not really stopping. It's
uh-huh.
thinking about work,
yeah,
thinking
yeah,
about
yeah.
how I can get more work, how I can improve myself. So,
yeah.
so I'm always looking into the new project I can do for myself. Or for a client.
Make a podcast,
like, if I'm not busy enough. But, like, for me, it's always about improving myself somehow.
Yeah.
I am on that relentless journey.
Yeah.
And that is what kills me. Because when it comes the time where I have to stop and read 3 books and play some video games,
yeah.
I feel bad about it and I want to do something else. So, like, I'm a bit trapped into this mentality
yeah.
that is...
Well, I think it's twofold. I think one, I think the society around you or the society and the culture around the field that we work in, I think that's geared towards making you feel guilty about not working. And I think that personally, as a freelancer specifically, you are legitimized in part by how much work you put in. Like if you put in more work than the other guy, or the other woman, then you have that kind of moral authority to be like, hey, I'm putting more work than you. You know, it legitimizes your position. And then the society around us, the culture around us, the work culture, is driving towards, hey, self-improvement's really important. Hey, you should be listening to these podcasts because they're going to inform you more. That isn't time off. It's time. It's about betterment. It's, you know, get ahead of the next person. And it seeps into your personal life, I think, in a big way.
That is a very good point. I think we're a bit trapped into that mentality. It's also, I mean, we're back to this social media issue, right? Because you're surrounded by this. I mean, I know you are really big on Twitter, for instance, meaning that you use Twitter
relentlessly. Yeah, it's the only one I use. Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll say that Pablo is very good at Twitter, if that makes any sense. But like, I think that like Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, whatever is your weapon of choice, they really do put you in that state of mind.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to an animator who you know as well, Dan Castro. We were speaking. He's a very good animator. How it feeds into feeling negative and burnout as well, which is that you are bombarded with images every day, and it's. As an illustrator, for example, if we use that as the broadest term of what I do, I can go on to Twitter, and I do go on to Twitter, and there, front-facing, will be a new piece of someone's best work, or at least strong work, in a field that I work in, even if it's sometimes just tangentially related. So there is a new standard, and then 5 minutes later, there'll be another new standard. And another new standard. And so even if they themselves, the individuals who put up that work, haven't produced any other good work, are in a total mire and are feeling terrible about themselves, because their good work is coupled with someone else's good work, it gives an impression of the overall landscape around you being this overwhelming place where people just are incredible all the time, you know?
Yes.
And it's exhausting. And you know, apart from anything else, I think the damage it does to your ability to retain your vision, as opposed to it being an amalgamation of a bunch of other people's visions. The amount of times I've been on social media, Twitter specifically, and I've gone, oh God, I want to steal that. I want to take a component of what they're doing and put it into my own work. Without maybe I don't think that's healthy. I think pinballing between your influences, pinballing between stylistic choices or material choices, is not good. It's not good. And maybe this happened before social media. Maybe I'd be at a library, quietly, and existentially having a big panic, with a bunch of like art books open in front of me. Maybe.
I know, but like that would be like you looking for that panic.
Well, I'm still looking for it.
But like now it's at your fingertip. You don't need to go to the library anymore, right?
Yeah.
You just get your phone out.
You can make yourself suffer like with one tap.
Yeah, you're dying by tapping.
Yeah.
Little taps.
Maybe the librarian would intervene. Or
they would kick you out of the library.
Take the books off you.
Stop crying over my books. You suck. So Instagram, there was a time I was on Instagram like 4 to 6 hours a day, easy. And it was working, you know, I was having a great following, I was getting lots of likes and comments, and I had people liking my work. At the time I was drawing a posted face every day as my own project to get better at drawing. And I remember being sucked into this world that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It doesn't exist. In my version of that, like there's this really kind of cruel, it will happen to you as well, but there's this really kind of cruel divider, which is fan art and original art.
Oh man, that must be insane.
It's just a crazy division, and it illuminates everything. It makes everything so clear. If you post something which is fan art that is related to an existing property, it will, at least in my experience, and my experience of watching other people do it, always be wildly popular versus something that has no existing connection, that is an original piece that isn't tied to an existing franchise or whatever. And so then you've got to examine what is success on that platform then. Because if success is just pointing at something and going, look, I know what that is, and I've drawn a facsimile of it, is that successful? Is that what you want? Do you want to succeed in those terms? I don't think so. I don't think that's a victory. I don't think that's improving your craft. I mean, it might be a really great drawing of that existing property, but it's still an existing property. And if that equates to more success in terms of likes and retweets or whatever, then I don't know. I think it's a really hollow success. Now, it gets way, way murkier and way more complicated when that success isn't just likes, isn't just retweets, but actually then becomes real offers of work, right? Then it gets way murkier. That's why my relationship with, for example, Twitter is way, way murkier. If I could just draw a line under it and go, okay, well, if I want the metric of my success to be likes or retweets, then I could dip in and out, I think, easier. And because I could go, hey, I want to draw a piece of fan art and I won't get more followers or whatever. But when your success on Twitter or any other platform actually starts to bring in people offering you real work, then it becomes really confusing. Should I keep doing this fan art? Because it gets more eyes on me, has in the past translated to more offers of work. The amount of work I get, probably 80% of it comes through Twitter or associated parties through Twitter. Just crazy.
That's why I think you're doing Twitter really well. It's like, in a way, but also you did draw a mean Furiosa when Mad Max came out. It was amazing. It was so good. But you know, it's his mentality, right? Is what I just said. It's, yeah. Like, it's that fact that it's easy to recognize branded material and it's easy to relate to it. But actually, when you draw something that is not branded, the effort of creating something from scratch is never rewarded, or is rewarded a lot less. So in terms of style, when you were saying, and I want to touch on that a bit more, is like how, because you're talking about this murkier relationship, right? And how do you navigate that on your own style?
Yeah.
But you know, how did you develop that? Trying to steer away from what is branded, what other great, amazing illustrators that also you know personally are doing.
Yeah.
And how do you keep that voice for your own work?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. And I would say this is the danger of consuming social media. So I don't know how much that landscape has informed my work. I would say a lot. You know, I come from like a traditional school of drawing. I was like a traditional illustrator. And so, but now my work isn't that traditional. And it's definitely been informed by people around me. And I think both for positive and negative, I probably my use of colour is way better than it would have been, because I've seen people using colour in really exciting ways consistently. And so you start to, by osmosis, kind of take that stuff in. But equally, I've probably ping-ponged through a bunch of different influences, and that's maybe slowed down my development down a single focus path. Like, I wonder how much my vision, in inverted commas, has survived all these different influences. Or if it's become so battered and weaved and changed that it's become my vision plus all these other things around it. And that's maybe not a bad thing.
I mean, that sounds like a normal thing, right?
When yeah.
Or like, it sounds like a positive thing that you kind of build, you have your own voice, but you also build around what you see.
Yeah, yeah. Although I think we probably agree that the people we really admire probably have really distinctive styles, or like are visionary styles. And I wonder whether this landscape kind of adds a bit of uniformity to the whole thing, because you're constantly seeing the same images. Like, that visionary person will then trickle down and inform a bunch of other people. In the comics world, for example, I could hold up a number of artists and just go, their style has directly informed these people. And now you get essentially copycat artists whose work is really hard to distinguish from the original person. And it's a really bizarre thing. And it happens. Like, there's a very famous comic book artist and writer called Mike Mignola, right? He made Hellboy. And his style's really appealing. And I think, like, loads of people hold him up as the kind of the standard, the high standard for comic book art, because it's abstract and interesting. So it doesn't blend in with all the other stuff. But it's, like, really simple. It's all about these big black shapes and big blocks of white and, like, flat colours. So the actual mechanics of making it are, like, seductively simple, even though he's incredibly talented and has worked a lifetime developing the style. You can't just approximate it. But then you could see that work infiltrating other people's work, right? But now it's like the time schedules become so compressed because social media is so 24 hours. I've seen artists rise to prominence, and then 6 months later, they're informing a new wave of artists who've got their proxy style down from that initial artist in 6 months. You know, because they're just coming across it all the time.
So it's harder to pinpoint a style then. Like, if it takes so little time for somebody to quote unquote copy your style, then it's like, how do you know, if you don't know the original artist, how do you know that what you're watching, what you're seeing on social media is unique?
Totally. Maybe the uniqueness of your product, your vision, becomes less important because it gets disseminated so quickly. It's out there so quickly that people start being influenced by it so quickly. You know, again, Mike Mignola, when he rose to prominence, you know, you'd buy his books. And so you'd have a book, and so you'd be at home practicing with a book beside you if you wanted to copy his style. And so that would inform your style. But then maybe that would inform your style too much, because that would be the only influence that you've got, as opposed to all these images coming at you at once. I think it's fascinating. I think social media is a disgusting thing. I sound ancient for complaining about it. In terms of seeking validation, in terms of equating success to this numerical value of retweets and likes, I think that is hideous. But it's totally infected me and my industry and everyone around me. You know, it just is. That's just the way it is. But seeking validation in those terms is just horrible.
So would Pablo Clark, the illustrator, professional illustrator,
yeah,
and successful illustrator, come on, yeah, we could say that. Would he exist if there was no Twitter?
That's a really good question. Well, if we just use that number that I said, which is like 80% of my work comes through Twitter. No. Or I'd be 80% poorer, which would be very, very poor. So I guess not. That's probably the truth. But then maybe I'd be more proficient at finding work through different avenues. You know, maybe I wouldn't be so reliant on this thing.
Right. Okay, I've got another question for you then. Do you remember a time, once upon a time, where Twitter wasn't Twitter? I mean, it was Twitter, but not the Twitter we know today, right?
Yeah.
And I remember you telling me your story when you were in Spain, developing, honing your craft.
Yeah.
So, like, there is a question I ask everybody before we even start the podcast, but today we started the podcast with a bang, so fuck it. The question is, what was your origin story?
If we're talking about the professional person I've become, that's not the right word to use, but,
but
not
like,
for me. No, but it's chaotic, I would say, is the origin to what I've done. I'd say that I'm naturally a pretty chaotic person. I'd say that I value certain things about art. I really value storytelling, and I really value craft. And those two things have kind of, between that and circumstance and chance, has created the situation that I'm in. So I do storyboards partially by chance. I illustrate partially by chance. There's no design. And I know artists, and not just artists, but people who work in all sorts of fields, who have a way clearer, purer vision of what they want to do, and they translate that effectively into the practical circumstances around them. So their career path arrives at a place in a way straighter line. I'd say mine is really, really chaotic, and still is. I still am like opportunistic in terms of where my career goes.
So tell me about those days in Spain. How did you get there? And if you went to uni, what did you study at uni?
So I got into art school with a painting and drawing portfolio. I was like a straight A student, and I only applied to a single university. I only applied to Edinburgh Art School. That's super chaotic. Like, I didn't consider any other options. Had I not got into Edinburgh, I don't know what I would have had to take a year out, because it would have been too late to apply.
But then, like, you are incredibly focused, I would argue, then.
No, I think short-sighted. I mean, I really wanted to go to Edinburgh, but I hadn't educated myself around what other options there were. You know, it wasn't like I had gone through the portfolios of every other art school in the land. I only did an interview for Edinburgh. I only applied to Edinburgh. I was lucky enough to get in, although I have very mixed feelings about art school, mainly negative.
All right, tell me about those.
I think they take people in too young, or if they do take in people too young, or at the age that they do, the system is not designed to create effective thinking artists. I think it's the input I had at Edinburgh Art School, was minimal. It was. I got in with painting and drawing portfolio. I ended up specialising in film, and I specialised in film mainly because I felt really, really disillusioned with how they approach the craft of drawing. And I thought, I can always draw. I don't need any material components to draw, really. But filmmaking is something where, if I'm in an institution, I can take advantage of the materials that they have around, like editing suites and cameras and all that sort of stuff. And I could learn a bunch of stuff because I didn't know much about filmmaking. But even then, the input was really lackadaisical. It was more like, here's a bunch of stuff, now go off and create. And I find that so lazy, because the act of creation should come naturally if you're in those places. I can go and create whenever I want. What I want is resistance, intellectual resistance, academic resistance. I want to be pushed and trained, and my ideas to be challenged, not to be just encouraged like by default. You know, there's plenty of ideas that are rubbish and should be absolutely challenged, you know. And then maybe in defense of those ideas, you know, you prove the ideas are good or whatever, and new things get created. But I didn't find any of that. And maybe that's the weird alchemy in me between my personality and that institution, that specific institution, or whether it's that institution was at that time maybe dog shite. I don't know.
I agree there is a problem there, and I don't think it's the ECA problem in particular. I think the problem is with the institutions right now, that they're not there especially or specifically to teach. They are businesses at the end of the day. And this, their businesses is predicated on kids graduating and kids coming in and signing up. Not, I'm not talking generically because that's like it's very like a gross generalization. In my experience, there is a problem with lowering the bar instead of setting the bar higher. So I think this pushing and prodding of like trying to get students to learn and push their own boundaries, their own knowledge, which I think is key in College of Art, because that's it. You need to find your voice, so you need to create, you need to make stuff.
Yeah.
But you also need somebody to sort of address you, not take you by hand, but like challenge you with your beliefs. That will push the bar higher.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah.
And you'll find certain kids will resist to that. You know, especially when you're that young, because when you said that we go in the UK, you know, you end up in uni that you're very young.
Yeah.
I believe that and you might not be strong enough.
Yeah, no, I wasn't.
To deal with the friction that there is when somebody challenges you. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I understand why they do certain things the way they do it.
Yeah.
But I think there is a problem with a bar that is too low.
Yeah, I think it's... And Edinburgh... There's a kind of dilemma here, because Edinburgh, or at least as I understood it, did get rid of quite a lot of people in the first year. Like, I knew people who didn't make it through first year. But I felt that the bar that was being set there was submit a certain amount of work, not the quality of the work. And so that's to me still a low bar. I had another friend, she was American, Caitlin. Shout out to Caitlin.
Shout out to Caitlin.
We'll never hear this, but she was
great. Hey, what are you trying to say here, man?
Well, no, I know nothing. She said one time, I'm not going to get kicked out. I know how much I'm paying to be here, you know, as a foreign student as opposed to local student.
That's a bit entitled.
Well, no, it's very pragmatic. She was just like, hey, this institution runs with the money that people like me put into it. So she wasn't worried about being chucked out, not because of the strength of her work, although her work was really good, but she was just like, no, I think. It makes financial sense that they keep people like me in. You know, art schools in particular are a weird one, because let's say you come out with a qualification in statistics from a university or something like that. That can then be directly applied to it's kind of almost a direct one-to-one measure of how good you are at statistics. And so you can then take that on into the wider world. It has a greater value. With an arts degree, I got a first in directing films, right? It's way, way more ambiguous as to whether I'm a good director, which I'm not, and how that can be applied in the wider world. So I think what art school should endeavour to do is create really, really good artists. And I think that intellectual resistance and practical resistance and a focus on skills is really, 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 really important. It's something that I felt I didn't get. So after I came out of art school, I was at a loss of what to do next. My first job in that world was working for STV. I did editing for them and I wrote copy for them. And it was a nightmare. I don't want to speak badly of that company. It was a nightmare because that job ran into my ambitions and expectations of a life after art school, you know, like of a straight eight student with a first, coming out with a bunch of ideas and then just hitting a brick wall. So yeah, it was strange seeing like, oh, is this how my skill set will be practically applied? That really threw me off.
That's another great point, which is the lack of business preparation like understanding from anybody coming out of uni, really. But like I think like even getting people that works in industry to come and talk to you on how the industry works, but like, this is what you're going to sit down and do.
Yeah,
this is how you can charge people, this is what you're going to get paid.
Yeah I had none of that, and none of that was discussed at all,
you know? It's like that way it becomes like you are what, 22 when you're out of uni here?
Yeah, I was, I think when I graduated I was 22, yeah, just turned 22.
You're young. Yeah. Like, you, I know that making your own experiences is important, and you can't really, like, there's only so much you can teach at school, but I think a couple of, or even just a module that teaches you how taxes works,
yeah,
how money works.
Hey, I could use that now.
Yeah. Like, what a pension is, why, yeah, you should, yeah, have a pension. Yeah. Why do you not? Yeah. This is like basic understanding that you have to teach yourself, or you're not gonna ever gonna know it.
Maybe the argument is that you know, you should sort of know this stuff. I don't know. I think you're pushed into this world that encourages you to go out and create, but provides none of the stuff around the act of creation. Like, if you want to create stuff, well, that's really good, but under what circumstances are you going to do it?
How do you sell?
Yeah, how do you apply that to the wider world? If you just want to create in a bubble and you want to have a job that sustains that, that's totally legitimate. But, you know, teach people to think in that way. You know, compartmentalize time, all that sort of stuff. It just goes on and on and on.
Time management is really important. Never teach you that.
Yeah, I wish they taught me. Still learning that as well.
So, Pab, after STV Creative, what happened?
Spent loads of time in working in bars and not doing. I spent loads of time. I was playing music, and I was living in a city that I didn't really like, and I was hanging around with a lot of people who were creative, again in like big quotation marks, inverted commas, but often they weren't actually creating anything. They were just wearing the mantle of creating things, and so I found that really, again, and I was really guilty of it, you know.
Not creating.
Yeah, and so I got to a stage in my life where I went, look, I have a bunch of skill sets, but none of them are hugely developed or hugely advanced. I've got some innate talent. Let's just pick one thing and just get good at it, right? Instead of this kind of diffuse approach and hoping that the society around me would kind of like find a niche for my weird amorphous skill set, concentrate down on a single thing. So it was drawing, it was illustration. And as soon as I did that, I realized how bad it was. I realized, because I started really examining the landscape around me, the professional landscape, and I saw people who were older than me or younger than me or had completely different backgrounds or whatever, and they were just better than me. They were 100 times better than me, 200 times better than me. I came across people who, in my whole life, I will never be better than. You know, it was an incredibly sobering moment where I went, okay, well, some innate talent means very little compared to hard work and concentration. And people were often the product of like having a singular vision and just drilling down into it and being incredible at it. And so I thought, okay, cool. Here's my goalpost. Suddenly I have all this structure. If I am here, which is low, and I want to get there, which is high, I've got all these steps now where I can see people and I think I can probably catch up with them, or I can try and catch up with them, and then I can get better. I had suddenly all these goalposts to aim for, like start earning money from it. How good do I need to be for people to start paying me to do this? So that's a goalpost, it gives you a bit of structure. How good do I need to be to start doing that type of work? Okay, so I need to get better than those people, or at least as good as those people, or at least have as good public relations as those people, and so on, and just start working my way up. And that structure was invaluable, because I'm a chaotic person, and it gave me enough of a path to walk down, to get lost along the way, but to go down, yeah.
To at least have some sort of structure that you lacked after uni, and STV Creative was probably a good experience for you because you learned all that stuff.
Yeah.
although you might, as a person, you might have enjoyed the job more or less, but like it feels like that gave you that crash course that uni didn't give you.
Yeah, it did. It
and
did.
And like after that, you went to, I remember like you were in Glasgow at the time, you know.
Yeah, so working for STV, I was in Glasgow, and then I moved to Spain. And in Spain, I started freelancing part-time. And that's very loose. I mean, I don't consider that as freelancing, but I was, my days were split up between regular work. I was working two different schools in Spain. So I'd get home at like 9 at night, and then I worked till like 2 in the morning on illustration. And I did that for 2 years. And then the circumstances of how I was living there changed and who I was living with. I split up with my partner there, and I went to go and renew my job at a school, or like at another school. And I'd split up with this person the night before. And so I went to the interview, or not the interview, but I'd already gotten the job, but just like the sort of the paperwork part of it. And there was a bunch of other teachers all registering at the same time, because Spain loves like centralized paperwork centers. And so you're all there in like massive queues.
I'm sort of like bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Heaven or hell, whatever.
It's incredible, definitely not heaven. These labyrinthian like municipal buildings with like people queuing forever.
Sounds like Italy.
Yeah. It's they love it. And so I was there, and then I got to the, this is not an embellishment, I got to the, I was like beside myself, I was distraught. Been going out with this person for 6 years, super formative relationship. And I get to the like, the person I've got to hand all the paperwork over to, and I open up this little bag I had, and it's got no paperwork in it. It's got nothing. And Spanish people love paperwork. And so like, I didn't have anything. It was all back in the flat. I hadn't brought anything with me. I'd basically brought an empty bag. I'm like tear stained. I haven't slept.
And you'd be queuing for a couple of hours?
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Like a day I've been queuing. And then I just sort of like started mumbling about how I'm not going to do it. I'm going to be a freelance artist. And I just walk out of this like municipal building. And that's true. It's exactly what I did. I was like, well, look, here's this opportunity where I've been splitting my time between trying to hone my craft, trying to make contact with clients, and now I'm at the end of my tether with teaching, so just that's going away. And it always was the plan. Teaching was always just a means to pay for my existence. So I was like, right, I'm just going to call everyone, all my clients, and just go, hey, I've got a lot of time on my hands now, so can you hire me, please? And that's how it started.
Very kindly. Could you give me a job?
Yeah, please, quickly.
I guess, like, the bureaucracy in Spain finally gave you that little push that you needed.
Yeah, I think my brain snapped.
Your brain snapped.
I'd had enough. I'd had enough. And that's what I mean. I mean, you're going back to chaos. You know, that I didn't plan to have a breakdown in a Spanish municipal building. It just happened. And so from there I had to adapt and started approaching people for work. And then that first year of full-time freelancing was very hard. I mean, I was
right,
completely
Pab,
broke.
Give me some numbers. How much did you make that first year?
I made 7,000 euros.
Oh my God, that must have been really hard. So how did you survive in Spain then?
The rent was cheap. I got a bit of help from my parents. And then I landed a big job, which basically paid me a bunch of that money. So I had a storyboarding job. And it sort of got me through that first year.
God, but like that's the kind of, like it's a romanticized story, right? The person that goes and say, hey, I've just said, fuck it. I went off.
Yeah,
and did my
I've
own
chucked
day,
my old
chucked
life.
Chucked my life away. And like, I mean, it's not advisable, right? Especially if you have responsibilities.
No, it's so dumb.
But when you are in that age, I mean, we're talking about what, you were 25 at that stage?
No, I was at this point, I'm like 28.
And like you broke up with your girlfriend, you're in Spain, or like you're also bilingual. So for you going to Spain,
sure,
because your mom is Spanish, right?
Yeah, my mom's Spanish. I'm half Spanish. Like I'm fluent in Spanish or close to fluent.
So you didn't have issues in that respect. You
were No.
The issues there were purely personal, and you know, not they were personal, but also the actual job, like to honing your craft and get better.
Yeah, I mean I'd wanted to make this change. It just the circumstances aligned in a freaky way, where I just thought, okay, if I'm, why am I making money to survive? Can I take this plunge to try and make enough money to survive on, but shift gears so I'm just doing the thing that I love? And if I don't make that change, is it going to be another 2 years before I'm in that situation? Will I be another 2 years behind the curve? At some point, I had to go, well, by taking this plunge and it being really difficult, maybe I can start down a path that otherwise I'm just going to keep on deferring and deferring.
So like that first day, you walked out of the big bad building, the bureaucracy building, and you were in Madrid?
Yeah, in Madrid.
And you came out of it. How did you feel that moment?
insane. I mean, no, it felt great in some ways. Because similar to when I first started freelancing, or like even part when I decided that this was the thing I was going to focus on, drawing, it started to clarify a bunch of stuff. Like, okay, you're not this good. You're actually this good, which is way lower. And you'd like to be, how do you get better? Deciding to do it as your profession, your full-time profession, adds a whole other set of rules. Right, well, now I know I need to approach people with the aim of making money in this way. Now I need to start being more forward-facing and professional. Now I need to create a work schedule that doesn't include a secondary job or my primary job at the time, but is now all focused around artwork.
That's very interesting. Like the saying that, like, because for a lot of people, there is that saying, okay, I can do this around a secondary job.
Yeah.
So in your mind, you always have that plan B. Well, you just removed that plan B and you were like, solely focus on what you wanted to do, which was drawing, become an illustrator, full-time illustrator, which is extra hard.
Yeah,
and it's like music. A career in music is a nightmare.
Yeah,
and like I feel like with all the people that work in the industry and do what you do, it always feels like that because you're all constantly chasing the project that is going to give you a break, or you're constantly chasing your project that's going to pay the bills, and it's like it's a very erratic way of working.
Yeah.
What I want to know from you is, the first year in Spain that you made €7,000 and you managed to survive, how was that process?
It was. I'd say that it was defined by being nebulous, right? Which is so. And I think probably a career in, or being a creative in this way, is maybe like honing this stuff down. So at the start, you know, I'm like, right, well, I've got a list of clients that I've worked with before when I was working part-time. I'm going to approach them, right? So that gave me a bit of structure. But then, you know, you start to examine, well, what am I, right? I'm an illustrator. So I can kind of draw quite pretty drawings. That was about it. That's all I could really do. And I had experience from film school of doing storyboards. So I was like, I can sort of draw all these pretty drawings, and I can... And I can do storyboards, and kind of, not very well. And what interests me? Well, storytelling interests me. And where does my skill set lie? Well, I think maybe it's probably in there, in that I did a lot of writing at film school, and I studied how to break down scenes and stuff like that. So, although that was more off my own back. But yeah, you get it. So I started trying to narrow it down. And then you start working with certain clients, and working with certain clients narrows it down a little bit more. Because then you can go, well, I'm a storyboard artist. After doing a certain amount of storyboards, you can go, well, I'm a storyboard artist. So suddenly it gives people a reason to hire you, either by the strength of your work, but also by what you do. You start to be able to solve a problem for people, or solve a problem that you yourself want to solve, because your skill set starts to become, and your experience starts to become less nebulous. So, you know, now I can sort of, I can call myself a storyboard artist, and I can call myself a comic book artist, and an illustrator. And those three things, I think, are fair enough to apply to me. But in that first year, I couldn't apply any of those things, really. I wasn't an illustrator in that I hadn't earned enough money to be an illustrator. And I felt like that was a criteria. Like, I should be able to survive on this, be very close to surviving. So, yeah.
When did you start surviving on it?
I mean, probably, yeah. I mean, I was technically doing it there, although, I did have some outside help. So, probably when I moved to Scotland.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a whole new topic.
Yeah.
Pablo Fernandez Clark life coming back to Scotland. So, tell me the moment, A, were you thinking about coming back to Scotland when you were in Madrid that first year, and then let's say the sequent years, like.
Yeah.
Second of all, when you started thinking, and third of all, how it happened?
Well, so the thing about living in Spain, which became strange, I really love Spain, but the weird thing for me was that, so I started going freelance and I started engaging with clients, but the way that either opportunities fell, or the way that the means by which I could find work were not in Spain. So all my work was coming from external clients. I did a storyboarding job for some Americans. I did a bunch of illustration work for clients in London, some in Scotland. But none of it was in Spain. So I was living in this country, but all my work was coming from out with the country. And that was kind of weird. It's kind of discombobulating. And so I had that feeling that if I can't make those two things align, if I can't get my work from Spain, you know, should I even be in Spain? And also, I've got lots of friends and stuff like that in Scotland. And then I got, I think it was through Twitter, I got recommended to Jordan and Ian by someone who I knew, a musician I used to know, or still know, called Rob St. John. And I think he showed some of my work to Ian. I think just my personal work, because a lot of this time it's still my personal work that was getting me work.
Ian Greenhill, Studio Something.
Yeah, one of the founders of Studio Something. And then they asked me to do, for 2 years, those first 2 years when I was freelancing, at Christmas time, both years, they asked me to do weird illustrations for them. So Ian, he started getting in touch with me, and it'd be like, hey, right, so can you draw my business partner, Jordan Laird, can you draw him swinging through the jungle, rescuing Katy Perry? It's for his birthday. Could you do that in 2 days? And so I'd be like, oh yeah, okay. So I drew that, and then they asked me to draw this weird Christmas card with a bunch of people I didn't know that subsequently I got to know, like Skelf, for example.
Skelf, he was involved in the first season of Wild Park. He basically broke him down and all.
Well, we all broke down.
We all broke down, yes. But like he was taking Pablo's artwork and preparing it for animation, helping me out preparing it for animation. And he was doing some of the lip syncing work, which is basically, he was doing the boring jobs. Sorry, Scott.
They kept asking me to do these weird jobs. And then out of the blue, they said, could you come and do a test for a week on this animated series? Which is, again, ties into that idea of chaos. I said yes, obviously. Not done any animation work before. Not really done any, illustration in that way. Like, pure characters kind of moving around in locations or, placing them in locations. That isn't really what I was doing. Not really. I mean, storyboarding has some of that, but it's kind of two different things, because cartoons are much more about the technical flourish and the look of it. So that was really interesting, because it clarified a whole bunch of things again. I had to go in a week and start designing characters, and they had to be there was all this practical criteria about how quick it had to be and the tone of it. And Jordan from Studio Something had already kind of like, they had already had some art assets, and you were already on board. So there was a bunch of structure and a bunch of ideas, just about how can we clarify that into a final thing. And I think that's moments like that are really, really useful and important, because that resistance brings out loads of good ideas.
Yeah. I mean, like, it was a crazy project to begin with. I mean, I remember the guys had just started the studio, the agency at the time, the little shop, and I had gone freelance a few months prior, and I just finished a big project for a TV show. And I remember coming into their office just to say hi, and they were making this silly animation, yeah, which actually made it to the final series, which is the guide dogs animation.
Yeah.
And like, it was very rudimental, but actually it kind of worked. It worked that it was in a certain way. And it was all ahead. It was like the mouth moving. And I remember the Jordan asking me, how do you make the mouth move? And I'll just show it quickly. And I was like, that's it. And like, but it had something. And I remember distinctively the way Wild Park happened. It was like, to me at least, they asked me, can you make a series of this?
Yeah.
And I was like, of course. Yes. How many do you need? And he's like, we don't know, but we're going to talk to the client and see what's up. But like, can you do it? And I was like, yeah, no problem. We'll figure out some, there'll be some details we need to figure out. But like, I mean, I'm always of this idea that everything is figure outable, you know, as long as you have a little bit of skill and you know what you're doing, it's fine. So off I went. That was it. And then like about 3 weeks later, they're like, oh, by the way, we spoke to the client and we got in touch with this amazing illustrator, Pablo Clark. And I was like, who the fuck is Pablo? And I was like, okay. So I went there, I looked at his stuff, and I was like, oh, he's really good. And he was like, okay, so now we're just waiting for the client to give us the get go.
Yeah.
And then like a week later, no, I was about another month later, I got a phone call that says, oh, we're starting next Monday. We got pitch week, we got this opportunity to make this happen. And like, I was over the moon, because the idea was absolutely madness.
Yeah.
And that was it. Like, we met that week, and I remember we talked about Smash Brothers on the 3DS.
Yeah, and we bonded over
video games, because Pablo is a huge, huge nerd.
Yeah.
And I bought 3DS Smash Brothers with the hope that we were gonna do this project, because the pitch week, we didn't know Wild Park was happening.
No. And it was so quick, you know. They flew me over. That felt great, you know, like going from like earning nothing to someone flying you over. That felt good. It felt like they were, and Jordan and Ian were really good at this, which is doing things the right way, like in terms of treating people well.
Yeah.
I think that was really,
they take care of people.
It put me at ease, you know. I was like, right, well, I'm coming over into this new situation.
And I remember when we started, distinctively I said, right, I just need you to draw the assets in Illustrator. And you had a panic attack almost. And you're like, what?
What's Illustrator?
Because Pablo always used Photoshop to draw his work.
Well, and even then, I mean, I've been using Photoshop for a while, but I still did a lot of stuff traditionally and then scanned it. So it was even more frightening.
Like, and I assumed that Pablo knew for Illustrator, because he's an illustrator, right? You must use Illustrator CC. you must know what it is.
The name. Yeah, that was frightening. Everything I know about Illustrator was taught to me in a hurry by Eric. we've got this deadline to hit. You need to learn how to do this quickly.
Go.
And I'd be going, I hate this. I hate Illustrator with such a passion.
You did kick a couple of tantrums.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, it breaks sometimes, and you're like, I can't do
this. I hate this.
I want to do Photoshop. Can I use Photoshop? What is this? And I was like, no, Pablo.
I had to draw the whole thing using this tool called the Blob tool. I say this all the time, but I have. You say that to a certain group of people who know what Illustrator is, and they're like, what?
Yeah.
You did what? You did...
Because what happened is, we had to use the Blob tool, because Pablo could not draw normal lines with Illustrator. He used the pen tools, and he didn't like the way the Illustrator brush works.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
It's like an anti-drawing
tool.
If I wasn't an expert in Illustrator, I had basic knowledge, but I had to work around Illustrator and make it more Photoshop.
I remember there was a bit where we were like, oh, we're just stuck because you can't draw using Illustrator, and so what are we gonna do? And then I remember we like, it was probably you who found it, but we like found a tutorial about the blob tool.
Because nobody uses
the blob tool. Oh my god! Oh my god! It's our salvation.
I remember that they were all elated by the fact that the blob tool is
basically a very rudimentary like facsimile of just drawing like how you would freehand or drawing how you would in Photoshop. And it kind of works, but it interacts really weirdly with Illustrator itself. Erasing the blob tool, like erasing your mistakes, is an exercise in going completely mad. Because everything starts to fragment, and so you end up with all these shards everywhere. They're all their individual like objects. Oh my god! I can feel my heart rate like going quicker and quicker.
And we didn't even talk about layers yet.
Oh yeah.
So
I'm on a job at the moment. I won't go too much into the job, but I was up on all this stuff. I was like, oh, you know, no, it's cool. I'll draw stuff behind the layers, and like we'll compartmentalize it, and then we can just attach it. We can make smart objects. This is all in Photoshop, but we can like, so we can move things around one go, and we can affect changes throughout the team. I was like, I knew all this stuff. Okay, smart objects. Unbelievable.
Yes, because I remember you, like, the way you use Photoshop as an artist would use Photoshop.
I use Photoshop like a series of bits of paper stacked on top of each other.
Exactly. And I remember when we talked about smart object, you were like...
I was angry. It's like witchcraft. I was like, no, that...
I don't want to use that.
I don't... That may... No. I didn't... This is totally my fault. This is a lack of experience. And we were speaking about this a bit before, but having crutches, like mistaking a technical crutch that you have for a thing that people want. So my crutch was like, I'm a traditional artist. I have this edge, even though I don't have much experience, I have this education in drawing. I was good enough to get into art school drawing. So I'm good at drawing, right? So any process that gets between me and drawing is like robbing me of my crutch. And if it robs me of my crutch, I started feeling super insecure. So it some ways it's positive because you're accentuating some of your strengths, but equally it stunts your growth, you know? I should have learned about smart objects then and not 2 years later when on another job. The client was like, no, you're doing that. You're doing it now, right? And I had a bit more confidence to be like, yeah, sure, I can learn that. But I think at the time, in the moment, I was so frightened of being robbed of the thing that made me good that I thought smart objects were made by the devil. I thought Illustrator was designed to deliberately thwart me and only me.
For those who don't know, smart objects are layers that you can group in Photoshop, but it's not just a group. It's also allow you to keep the quality of the layer to the best possible quality. Yeah. So that means that when you are building a scene or compositing a scene together, if you zoom in and zoom out with the camera, you don't lose the quality.
Yep.
And that's the main reason why we had to use Illustrator, because the camera had to zoom in and out, and we couldn't possibly draw everything at high resolution, because we didn't have the machinery to do it, and like we didn't have the power to do it, and also it required a huge amount of details that Pablo couldn't have possibly drawn, because there were too many assets that needed to be created. So when we decided that, in my mind, I was like, we need to use Illustrator because that's the only way we can work.
We did, because it had to be blown up to clarify a bit, like, yes. Wellpark appeared online, it also appeared on television?
Appear on television, appear in cinemas. Billboards. So it's like the assets had to be...
They had to scale right up and down.
Yeah. And Illustrator was the only way of doing it. But the best thing about this is like, besides the first weeks where we really, really like struggled with getting in the swing of things because we needed to be straight away, we needed to be at it.
Yeah.
Like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah, no, it was just, I moved over from Spain and like started working straight away.
And like Pablo nailed it and he had to learn Illustrator. At the same time, I had to get help. Shout out to Andrew.
McKelvey
to help us animate because we had way too many episodes. I couldn't animate possibly 2.5 episodes a week. I did it for a while, but I was losing my mind. And then the amends came in. Yet amend 5 episodes.
Yeah,
and
it
was insane. But the effort that Pablo made in that endeavor in those 2.5 months. Was that 2.5, 4? I think I said 4 months before, but I think it was 2.5 months.
I remember nothing at that time. It's just
It was a blur. It's a blur.
Blood and Bobby's face.
But I think it was an incredible effort, and we all learned a lot from it. Like I mean, Pablo learned Illustrator. I don't know. Are you still using Illustrator sometimes?
I sometimes say I can use Illustrator. I try to avoid it. I try to avoid it still because of that reason, which is. You know, I can draw, or like that's the thing that I sort of pride myself on or sell myself on now, and I still feel like Illustrator gets in the way for me. But then you see what other people can do with it. It's incredible. Like my little brother, who's the designer at Studio Something,
Ken Fernandez Clark.
Yeah, he's the art director, actually, I should say, at Studio Something, and he's just watching what he can do. In Illustrator is fantastic. It's a hugely powerful tool.
I think like there is that way that like you either learn Illustrator to do the stuff you do and it fits in your workflow or it doesn't.
Yeah. And for me, I think it just everything that I can do in by hand by drawing, I feel is what makes my work stronger. But I should definitely do more illustrated stuff.
I wanted to ask you specifically about being a comic book artist.
Yeah.
Because it's a job that is still seen as an end-all, be-all job for a lot of illustrators.
Yeah.
It's just like being a comic book artist has got this aura of being a special job, something that allow you to be a real artist, a real illustrator because you're making a comic book. So like, I want you to just... talk to me about that. Like, how did you feel the first time you got this kind of gig, and how do you feel now that you're comfortably in the industry?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm comfortably in the industry. I still like so I've had a bunch of stuff published with big publishers, but I still haven't worked on like a book length thing, which is the big, that's like the big next stage. And I'm in talks at the moment with doing a bunch of books, so I think that will come relatively quite soon. Comic books are really interesting because again, I came into them through a weird route where I was interested in storytelling. I admire a lot of comic book artists, and so I started fishing around for work in the comic book industry, or fishing around for jobs or opportunities, or speaking to comic book people. And I think comic books would be in some ways the ideal for me. If I could ultimately write and draw my own comic books, my own graphic novels, whatever, then that would be a pretty great place, I think, in terms of fulfilling my interest in storytelling and my interest in technical illustration, like being a good illustrator, being a good artist, like the craft side of it. So that's definitely an aim to try and get there. And I'm pursuing it quite hard, I think. But it's got, you know, it's a difficult world. And it definitely is one that is funded by my other work, by my pure illustration and by my storyboarding work. So Yeah, but it's an ambition, I think, to get there. And it allows me to draw pictures that for myself, or at least the relationship with the client is way closer, because it's the writer or it's the editor. It's not for an advert, or it's not for a an advert or an editorial illustration, for example, like in a magazine or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but your vision might be changed quite radically to fit the needs of the product or the demographic that they're shooting for. And so you maybe have to compromise more. And not that compromise is necessarily a bad thing, but I think having an outlet where you and the story and the making of the story and the making of the images are all a relatively small team with a lot of editorial control, you're all kind of in it together, then that's pretty exciting to me. Yeah.
Wow. So that is the goal.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the goals, yeah. I think I'm still exploring that world. I'm still new. I feel like I'm still new at a lot of this stuff. I'm still exploring that world and seeing what opportunities are out there. Like one of my big things is I really like storytelling. I really like writing scripts. But I feel like I need to get a couple of books under my belt with other people before I'm in a position to really push my own stuff. And I don't know whether that's a crutch that I'm leaning on or that's realistic. But I think I'd like to at least get one big book under my belt with a creative team of another writer and things like that before I start really pursuing me being the sole creator, specifically writer and artist.
I mean, that's a hell of a goal.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a goal, we'll see.
It's doable. Like, it was a hell of a goal to be where you are now, that day in Spain, you know, when you left. Would you have expected to be where you are now?
I don't know. I don't think I knew enough about the industry. I don't think I could have predicted the weird chance encounters that led to certain circumstances. I wouldn't have been able to predict any of that stuff. So I don't know. I would hope, I hope that I would look at my situation now and go, that's a positive. But I think the situation that I'm in is still in part defined by chaos. I'm still doing pure illustration. I'm still doing storyboards. And so there is a kind of like, there is a lack of stability and clarity that comes with that, that either will keep defining me or will slowly start to galvanize into a few core things that I do. And I'm trying to direct in that direction, I think.
Still on that path.
Still on that path, but really enjoy working on a bunch of things as well, because you get challenged and you get frightened, and that's useful. Yeah.
And you can get, you know, the cash to buy all the pretty things that we like.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Oh, God.
Shout out to any rich people listening to this podcast. Hire me.
Yeah. Hire Pablo, please.
Yeah.
On that note, Pablo, tell me where people can find you.
Depressingly, the best place to find me is on Twitter.
Oh, fabulous.
Exactly. I feel that, like, there's not enough mystery in the world, so I'm quite mysterious, don't have a website or anything. Like I said, chaos defines me and my process, I think. So, my Twitter is at InTheDarkArcade. And my email address is inthedarkarcade@gmail.com. And you can find me in the Leith Victoria gym a lot, hanging out there. And I also I rent a desk at the Studio Something Towers. They have this big old manse with a bunch of different people on it, including an old friend from school who I grew up with. He has a floor. He runs a business from a floor. My little brother works there.
It's like friends a family. There.
It's great, big dysfunctional family.
It's a big dysfunctional family. Yeah.
So hire me to do anything. I think I can do anything, just not that well.
Like hire him to do specifically a job where he has to use Adobe Illustrator.
Yeah. If one that's like has to be really technical, like really neat and tidy, nice tight deadline as well.
Yeah, something that you give him a week, a project that is so good that he can't say no. If you could do that for me, that would be amazing.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, thank you, Pablo Clark, for joining us today. Speak to you soon.
Bye. That was good. I need to pee so badly.